And so today you're in for a treat. You're not just gonna be hearing from one speaker. You're gonna be hearing from five different speakers who've prepared messages from people in God's word who've had to make this same decision, who've sat at the same crossroad, whether to go their own way or to be obedient in what God is calling them to. And so they're all different staff members within our church. They're gonna have their titles and their names up on the screen before they get up to speak and present. And so do me a favor and let's give it up for our five speakers as they make their way to the stage right now. Well, today, here's what I want you to do. I want you to get ready. And by getting ready, I think it could look like leaning in, getting ready to take notes, getting your journals out, whatever it is, however you take notes, being responsive, right? And it was one way that we can let them know we're here, but also celebrating each one after they're done speaking today, all right? So are you ready to jump in? You guys ready? All right, let's do this.
Hello. Have you ever tried something for the first time and like immediately regretted it right after? For me, that was snorkeling. I went on a cruise excursion a while back with my family and it was like a last minute decision. We didn't have anything to do. We were in Mexico and we're like, hey, why not? We're in Mexico. Let's go snorkeling. I was all for it. I was like, yeah, this is going to be fantastic. The fish are going to be far away from me. It's going to be great. So we get out into the ocean. Everything's good. There's not a whole lot of fish around. But then our guides in our boat decided it would be a great idea to take some food and some bread and just throw it out around us to entice the fish to come up. Well, one minute I was okay, and the next minute, no kidding, I had like 6 fish 6 inches from my face. And these weren't like pretty coral reef fish that you see on the TV. These were like giant, ugly fish inches from my face. I started freaking out. I started swatting at them, looking above the water, trying to find my husband, screaming for him with a mask on, which isn't very good. I found him, climbed on his back, grabbed his neck, and said, Garrett, get me back to the boat right now. And he takes me back to the boat, but he's just laughing at me the whole way back. Husband's quick note, not the way to react when your wife is panicking. But we got back to the boat, everything was fine, but I was completely embarrassed. I took a chance, went snorkeling in Mexico, and all I got was embarrassment and people laughing at me. Well, I love this series we're in, Chance of a Lifetime. But what happens if you take your chance, if you do something big for God, and people ridicule you for it? When I think of someone in the Bible that dealt with this, I think of Noah. If you don't know Noah's story, it's all the way back in the beginning of Genesis. It talks about how God was looking down on the earth and all he saw was corruption and evil and violence. And he decided that he was going to wipe out all living creatures from the earth. But he found favor in the sight of Noah. So he instructed Noah to build this giant ark or a boat to save his family and 2 of every animal from the flood. So Noah obeyed and he started building this giant boat. And it's a really awesome story, but I think oftentimes we skip over the details of the conditions that Noah was working under. You see, in the book of Luke, Jesus was talking to his disciples and he was talking about when he was going to come back again, but he was referencing the times of Noah. In Luke chapter 17, 25 through 26, but first, he must suffer many things and be rejected by this generation. Just as it was in the days of Noah, so will it be in the days of the Son of Man. You see, Noah wasn't well-liked. It wasn't like he was building this boat and everyone was cheering him on, saying, good job, good for you, Noah. He was being rejected, ridiculed from people that didn't understand what he was doing. But why is that small detail important for you to me to know? Well, we have to understand that if we choose to take a step, if we decide to take a big chance of a lifetime, a big risk for God, that sometimes it's going to result in ridicule. So what do we do? Well, we're going to look at the story of Noah and 3 reasons he was ridiculed and what we can learn from him. The first of which being was his age. You see, Noah was 600 years old when the floodwaters covered the earth. Now, granted, people lived a long time back then, but just imagine for a second, 600 years old, building this giant boat in the middle of nowhere. I mean, people were thinking this guy was just a crazy old man. But I think oftentimes we let our age hinder us from being used by God. We think we're too out for the count, that our time's over, or that we're too young. But in reality, God uses everyone. I love my dad. We always joke with my dad that retirement is coming. You're getting old. And he jokes with us. But he always tells us retirement is never an option. You see, there will come a day when he has to step back from his paying job. But as long as there's breath in his lungs, God isn't finished with him yet. Come on, are you thankful for a God that will use you right where you're at? He's not done with you. And that's that stance that Noah took, saying, no matter what, I'm going to keep going. God can use me. The second reason he was ridiculed was for his circumstance. You see, before Noah, there had never been a record or account of rain yet. In Hebrews 11:7, it says, by faith, Noah, when warned about things not yet seen, in holy fear, built an ark to save his family. Well, whether or not they had seen actual rain, they for sure had not seen rain destructive enough to wipe out the human race. So I find it pretty reasonable that people didn't understand what he was doing. I mean, it'd be like if you and I stepped outside of church today and all we saw was this giant boat being built in the middle of Albuquerque, New Mexico. I mean, what are you going to do with it? Put it in the Rio Grande? No, it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense. But Noah didn't second guess. He didn't make excuses for God. He kept his faith, which leads to that third reason he was ridiculed for, which was his faith. Genesis 6:7-8 says, so the Lord said, I will wipe from the face of the earth the human race I have created, and with them the animals, the birds, and the creatures that move along the ground, for I regret that I have made them. But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. Imagine being the only one on earth that was found righteous in God's eyes. See, Noah didn't have all the answers. He didn't know what this flood was going to look like. He didn't know what was going to happen after the flood. But he chose to take a chance on God. He chose to step out in one of the biggest acts of faith. And the reaction to his faith was rejection from everyone. But what we can learn from his story is not found in the rejection. It's found in Noah's response to that rejection. You see, he knew that his approval didn't come from man. It came from God. He knew it was only God who could tell him who he was. You see, today, God is asking you to do something big. God has your own personal chance of a lifetime. For Noah, it was the ark. But what's your ark? What is that one thing that you might be too afraid to do because of the possibility of comments, rejection, ridicule from others? What's your ark? God is just asking you to lean on him and trust in him. You see, because Noah didn't let up, because he stayed faithful, he saved his family and two of every animal from the flood. God sent a rainbow as a promise to us that there would never be a flood again. And Noah's name is mentioned in the book of Hebrews as one of the heroes of faith. We have to see beyond the reaction of others. James 1:2-4, my fellow believers, when it seems as though you are facing nothing but difficulties, see it as an invaluable opportunity to experience the greatest joy that you can. For you know that when your faith is tested, it stirs up in you the power of endurance. And then as your endurance grows even stronger, it will release perfection into every part of your being until there is nothing missing and nothing lacking. You see, when our faith is tested, our response determines everything. You can choose to let it stop you, or you can choose to let it push you closer to Jesus. You see, Noah had a chance of a lifetime, and he took it. But so do you. Will you take it? Thank you.
Church, how are we doing this morning? Doing good? Doing good. Well, hey, my name is Jonas. I'm from the great state of Texas. Where's all my Texans at? Make some noise. That's right. You know, being a Texan, I think there's two things that we can all agree on. Number one, we love our sweet tea. And I'm not talking about the sweet tea with just a little bit of sugar. I'm talking about the sweet tea where all you can taste is the sugar. Thank you for that. I need that. So I love my sweet tea. I'll drink it for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. It doesn't matter. I love sweet tea. The second thing I think we can all agree on is we love bread. And I'm not talking about like the stale communion cracker bread. I honestly didn't even know we were taking communion this morning. So we all got to experience that. But I'm talking about the bread where we go to Texas Roadhouse and you walk in and you just smell the fresh rolls and you get to your table. And as soon as you put that roll in your mouth, it just begins to melt. That's the kind of bread I'm talking about. There's actually a time in my life, I was just a little kid. I was probably about 4 years old, but my mom was getting dinner ready. So she put the rolls on the oven and she said, "Jonas, you're in charge of making sure these rolls get done on time." And I said, "Okay, I'm 4 years old. I don't really know what that means, but I'll do my best." And so my mom put the rolls in the oven and then she left the four-year-old Jonas in the kitchen, which is a story for another time. But she left me in the kitchen. She left me in charge. She threw on the timer. And I just remember standing there in the kitchen watching this timer tick down all the way to zero. As soon as it hit zero, I flung the oven door open. I had no idea what an oven mitt was, so I just grabbed the first thing I could see. I grabbed a big hand towel that was super long. I didn't fold it up or anything like that. So I reach in the oven, and as you can imagine, the bottom of the towel touched the bottom of the oven. And now using your imagination, you could assume that the towel immediately caught on fire. And so me being 4 years old, I had no idea what I was going to do in this moment. Like any sane four-year-old would have done, I threw the fire towel on the ground and I ran to the living room and hid behind the TV. As I was hiding behind the TV, I'm screaming, crying like, "Mom, you've got to come help me out." She comes running out there like, "What is going on?" And she knew exactly where I was just because she could hear me crying from behind the TV, but at least I felt safe. And you know, I think this is a funny story, but if we're being honest, I think there's some Christians in the room this morning, some people in the room this morning, and you're in the exact same boat. God has given you a calling. God has given you a plan, a purpose, and a task. And in somehow, some way, you've managed to set it on fire. And instead of wanting to put the fire out, what do? You just throw it down and you run and hide. And now there's a story in the Bible that I want to talk to you about. It's a guy by the name of Jonah. And I know we all know the story of Jonah and the fish, but hopefully I can take it a little deeper this morning. And so Jonah, he was an Old Testament prophet. This is someone that God loved, and he loved God with all of his heart. This is someone that he was actually born and raised in the northern kingdom of Israel. And so he goes through his life and God gives him this call to go to the city of Nineveh. But later on, you'll see that he ends up not doing that at all. And so I'm going to read to you Jonah chapter 1. Verse 1, it says this. "Now the word of the Lord came to Jonah, the son of Amittai, saying, 'Arise, go to Nineveh, that great city, and call out against it, for their evil has come up before me.' But Jonah rose to flee to Tarshish from the presence of the Lord. He went down to Joppa, found a ship going to Tarshish. So he paid the fare, went down into it to go with them to Tarshish, away from the presence of the Lord." Now, I think it's key here that God mentions twice in this scripture that he was going away from where he was supposed to be. And so we're going to pick up here in verse 11. It says, "Then they said to him, 'What shall we do to you that the sea may quiet down for us?' For the sea grew more and more tempestuous. He said to them, 'Pick me up and hurl me into the sea. Then the sea will quiet down for you. For I know it is because of me that this great tempest has come before you.'" So Jonah acknowledged that this storm that God had sent was because of him. He said, "Hey, hurl me into the sea and this storm will go away." And so we're going to pick up in verse 17. It says, "And the Lord appointed a great fish to swallow up Jonah, and Jonah was in the belly of the fish for 3 days and three nights." Now I look at this story and I think, man, getting hurled into the sea would probably be, it wouldn't be that fun. But imagine getting swallowed by a fish. Imagine what Jonah was going through while he was in the belly of the fish for 3 days and three nights. Imagine how easy it could have been if he just followed God's plan that he had for his life. But instead, he ended up a long ways away from where he was supposed to be. In fact, the city of Tarshish was 3,000 miles away from the city of Nineveh. And I don't know if anybody can relate to that this morning, but I know in my life, sometimes I feel like I'm a far ways away from where God wants me to be. And so there was actually a time in my life not too long ago where I found myself in this same place. I was a long ways away from where God wanted me to be. And I can remember exactly where I was, what I was wearing, what I was doing on a specific night where the enemy had really gotten to me on this night. I was sitting in my apartment, leaned up against my couch, a far ways away from where God had wanted me to be. And I was dealing with some very, very dark thoughts. I was having suicidal thoughts and thinking about ending my life and stuff like that. And I just remember sitting there thinking, "God, where are you in all of this? I've made so many mistakes. I'm not where you want me to be. I'm not doing what you want me to be doing. But how could I possibly get to where you want me to be?" So I was sitting there with tears streaming down my face and I just began begging God, "God, I need an answer. I need you to show me where you are in all this." And all of a sudden, I looked down on my phone, and my sister Lindsay, say hey. She was actually, she was FaceTiming me. And, you know, I just wiped the tears away, and I answered the call, and it actually wasn't Lindsay on the phone, but it was my two-year-old little niece, Lux, and she had the biggest smile on her face from ear to ear. And I just remember being in that moment thinking, God, what is this all about? And then out of nowhere, she just began saying my name over and over and over. She said, Jonas, 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 with the biggest smile on her face. And I just remember being in that moment. God used that moment to remind me that he was calling me by my name. It didn't matter the mistakes that I made. It didn't matter where I was, what I was doing, but he still had a plan and a purpose for my life. I think there's some people in here this morning who just need to be reminded that it doesn't matter where you've gone. It doesn't matter what you've done. Because if that were the case, I wouldn't be up here talking to you this morning. I think there's some people who just need to be reminded that God loves you so much and that he has a plan and a purpose for your life. You have the opportunity of a lifetime. And so what I want to encourage you with is, man, God's not going to force you to do anything that you don't want to do. So it's up to you. God is calling you by name, but my question to you is, will you answer his call? Thank you.
Living a meaningful life requires some grit. The dictionary defines grit as courage and resolve. And, you know, if you followed Jesus for any amount of time, you would probably agree with me in saying that following Jesus requires some courage and resolve. Can I get an amen? Yeah. So the great thing about grit, though, is that it really doesn't require having a high IQ. And having grit really doesn't require having talent either. The great thing about grit is that it's really more of a decision that we make. Having grit is really more of a commitment, and it is a discipline. And when I think about gritty living for God, I think of the story of Job. So Job had a decision to make in his life. He had the chance of a lifetime, you could say. He had the opportunity to choose to trust and to worship God, even in the midst of having everything taken away from him. So what we know in the first chapter in the book of Job is that he was a very wealthy man. He had a lot. He had a big family. He had a lot of possessions. He had a lot of wealth. And it says very specifically some things that he has. It even says he has 3,000 camels. Hashtag bless life. That's a lot of camels. But it says he was the greatest man in the East. So what we know is that Job was in a very good season of life, right? Like everything was going so well for him. He had everything. He had all the wealth, all the family, all of the things that he could ever want or ask for. He was in a very good season of life. And when we are in that kind of place in life, that's a pretty easy place to worship God from, right? But what about when God allowed everything to be taken from Job? What about when everything he had on earth was taken away? What was his response then? And what about us? What about when everything is taken from us? What about when we are experiencing loss? What is our response then? Job 1, 8 through 12 says this. Then the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There is no one on earth like him. He is blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil. Does Job fear God for nothing?" Satan replied. "Have you not put a hedge around him and his household and everything that he has? You have blessed the work of his hands so that his flocks and herds are spread throughout the land. But now stretch out your hand and strike everything he has, and he will surely curse you to your face." The Lord said to Satan, "Very well then, everything he has is in your power, but on the man himself, do not lay a finger." So in further chapters, to make a long and very painful story short as possible today, we can see that everything was taken from Job. His wealth, his possessions, his family, his health, everything that he held dear was taken from him, and he quickly found himself in a very dark place of despair and loss. So we can see that Job did two things in this hard season. The first thing is that Job mourned. Job 3:3-4, Job says, "May the day of my birth perish, and the night that said a boy is conceived, that day may it turn to darkness. May God above not care about it. May no light shine on it." And that sounds pretty intense and pretty dramatic, right? It's easy to stand back and say, wow, that's pretty dramatic. But if we're being honest in this room today, I think so many of us have been in such a dark place that we would say something like, "I wish I wasn't even born. God, where are you? What are you doing?" So we see in Job that he complains a lot. And in fact, there are chapters and chapters and chapters of Job complaining. You know, this is a natural human response to mourn and complain and to really just go through it when we're facing something dark in life. And I think it's so important to acknowledge that we need to do that, right? We need to mourn. We need to process. We need to acknowledge what we're facing and what we're going through. But the important part is that we don't get stuck in that place, right? We need to acknowledge the feelings. We need to feel the feelings. We need to process, but we need to progress through it. You see, what's so great about God is that he can handle our complaints. I'm so grateful for that because I've had a lot of complaints myself in the past. But we can't forget to be quiet long enough for God to respond to us. Jeremiah 29:12-13, God says, "Then you will call on me and come and pray to me, and I will listen to you. You will seek me and find me when you seek me with all of your heart." And what's so interesting about Job's story in this dark season that he's going through is God actually doesn't respond to him until chapter 38. The second thing that Job does is he repents and he worships. Job 42:1-6, Job says, "I know that you can do all things. No purpose of yours can be thwarted. You asked, 'Who is this that obscures my plans without knowledge? Surely I spoke of things I did not understand, things too wonderful for me to know.' You said, 'Listen now, and I will speak. I will question you, and you shall answer me. My ears have heard of you, but now my eyes have seen you. Therefore, I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes.'" So we see that when Job decided to move from a place, a posture of complaining to repentance, God's heart is moved. And oftentimes in our situations, I think what we need more than we need a different outcome to our situation is we need a greater reliance and trust and dependence on God. We have to learn how to trust the process that God so often submits us to and trust that it is for our good. Job 42:12-17, the story ends like this. "The Lord blessed the latter part of Job's life more than the former part. And so Job died, an old man and full of years." And in case you were wondering what happened to those 3,000 camels of Job's, it says that the Lord actually gave him 6,000 camels in the end. Hashtag super blessed life. The great thing about grit is that it's not about how you start, but it is about finishing. Even when the odds seem completely against you, even if you trip and fall a couple times along the way, when we decide not to give up on God, we see his goodness in the end. Jeremiah 29:11, "For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord, plans to prosper you and not to harm you, plans to give you a hope and a future." And just like Job, you have the opportunity of a lifetime. We have the opportunity of a lifetime to recognize that your life and that my life is so much more than the things that we possess here on the earth. That even if we lost everything that we had, we still have a God that loves us more than anything. We have a hope that's bigger and greater. It's an eternal hope. When we go through the fires of life, we can trust that God is using them to refine us. And with that kind of hope that we have, we can have grit in every circumstance. Thank you.
Here loves basketball. All right, several people. You guys keeping up with the playoffs? Go ahead and shout your favorite team. Nice, nice. I'm a Mavericks fan myself. So I love basketball. And when I was a kid, I did what every kid would do. And I would imagine myself in the game 7, 3 seconds left, tie game with the fate of the universe on the line, taking the last shot, right? And then what I would do is I would dribble in, I would cross out some defenders, I would throw up a prayer, yell Kobe. And then if it went in, the crowd would go wild, right? The imaginary crowd. But if it didn't go in, I would basically yell foul and say, all right, put 3 seconds back on the clock. Let's try it again. And basically, I would just rinse and repeat until I finally made it. But how many of you guys know life doesn't necessarily work like backyard basketball? So in life, there are no redos, but maybe we're going to see with our story today that there maybe are second chances. So we're going to be taking a look at Peter. And to save time on some context here, I'm going to give you some of Peter's greatest hits, just to make it short. So to start off, he was a disciple. He was a fisherman. He was a close friend to Jesus, part of his inner circle. He was one of his best friends. He was a witness to multiple miracles. And to top it off, he walked on water, which is like a pretty strong flex on the rest of the disciples. And overall, it's a pretty nice resume. And the thing is, Peter, he was known for his boldness. He would do anything. He would stand up. He would take action. He would chop a guy's ear off. He was that kind of dude, right? So he's crazy. And he always had this boldness, except for this story in Luke. So we're going to take a look at Luke 22, 54 through 62. It says, then seizing him, so they're arresting Jesus in this moment, they led him away and took him into the house of the high priest. And then it says, Peter followed at a distance. So this part's really important. So I'll say it again. Peter followed at a distance. We'll come back to this. And when some there had kindled a fire in the middle of the courtyard and had sat down together, Peter sat down with them. So we can already see in the story, Peter is trying to blend in with the crowd. Then a servant girl saw him seated there. She looked closely at him and said, this man was with him. But he denied it. Woman, I don't know him, he said. A little later, someone else saw him and said, you were also one of them. Man, I'm not, Peter replied. About an hour later, another asserted, certainly this guy was with him. This guy, he was with Jesus, right? Did you see him? Then Peter replies again, man, I don't know what you're talking about. And just as he was speaking, the rooster crowed. The Lord looked and turned straight at Peter. Then Peter remembered the word the Lord had spoken to him. Before the rooster crows today, you will disown me 3 times. And he went outside and wept bitterly. So we can take away 3 different things from this story. The first one is that Peter didn't want to be associated with Jesus. And it wasn't because Peter didn't love Jesus. It was because Peter was afraid. Honestly, if they knew that Peter was associated with Jesus, they just as easily would have arrested him and taken his life. So Peter was scared. He tried to save his own skin, and that caused him to deny Jesus. The next thing, like I pointed out earlier, is he followed at a distance. And so Peter, again, was this guy of great boldness. But whenever he started creating this distance between himself and Jesus, his boldness started to dwindle. He put this separation in between there, and it caused him to stumble. And so the third takeaway from this is he denied knowing Jesus in front of one girl, then a small crowd. And so you have to assume if he didn't have the boldness to talk about Jesus in front of one person, how would he ever do it in front of the masses, right? But how many of you know that even in our mistakes, even in our screw-ups, and even in our shortcomings, the grace of Jesus is so much bigger than anything we could ask for, right? So I have one point. I'll make it nice and simple for you guys today. My one point is failure isn't final. So the next part of this story is in John 21, 15 through 17. It says, when they had finished eating, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? Yes, Lord, he said, you know that I love you. Then Jesus said, feed my sheep. And he really didn't understand what he was saying at this time. It's kind of weird, right? Feed my sheep. What does that mean? Then Jesus goes on to say again, Simon, son of John, do you love me? He answered, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. And Jesus says again, take care of my sheep. And then for a third time, Simon, son of John, do you love me? And at this point, Peter's like, what the heck, man? You've asked me two times already. This is the third time. Like, I've already told you. He's like, you're God. You know all things. You know that I love you. Then he says, one more time, feed my sheep. What was happening in this story is Jesus was reinstating Peter. He was saying, do you love me? Do you love me? Do you love me? Three times for the three denials that Peter had. Aren't you thankful for a God like that? And not only does Jesus forgive Peter in this moment, but in Matthew 16, it says, Jesus calls Peter the rock and says, on this rock, I will build my church and the gates of hell will not overcome it. How incredible is that? This is Peter's story arc. He goes from denying Jesus in this moment in front of this one girl to then wondering if Jesus would ever trust him again. Was he blacklisted? Was Jesus not his friend anymore? He goes from this moment to then being the cornerstone piece for which Jesus would build his church. And then Peter gets a chance of a lifetime. He goes out and preaches an amazing gospel message, and 3,000 people were saved that day. That's a pretty incredible first sermon, if you ask me. So what Peter learned in his mistake, what he learned in his first mistake, that's the lesson he needed to set him up for his greatest opportunity. Maybe you're in here today, and maybe you've distanced yourself from Jesus. Maybe you're following at a distance. Maybe you've lost your boldness. I want to let you know today that Jesus isn't mad at you. He's not upset at you. He loves you, and he wants you to return to him, and he'll be there with open arms. Jesus is that good. So I ask you today, and I close with this. Will you choose to blend in with the crowd, or will you choose to stand up and follow Jesus? Thank you.
Your counts. I was a cheerleader for 12 years of my life, and I absolutely loved it. It taught me a lot of important life lessons, but one of the most important things I learned was how to stay focused in the middle of chaos. Now, if you've ever been in a cheer competition, let me tell you, screaming constantly. I mean, you can't get any silence in there. There's booming music. You can't even hear yourself think. It's probably some remix of Bruno Mars or whatever the popular song that is of that year. You just can't focus. And so it could be really easy to get distracted when you're performing your 2 minutes and 30 second routine. So our coach has made sure to ingrain it into us to know our counts. Now, what are counts, for those of you who don't know, are just numbers assigned to movement. You wave on one, you slap on two, you walk on three. You get the picture. And so it's important that we knew by muscle memory so that we wouldn't be swayed by the chaos happening around us. Now, not everyone in here has cheered or been in the same situation, but I have a feeling that we all have felt what it's like to be in an environment of chaos. I mean, I could say 2020 and all of us would go, yeah, that was crazy. I mean, the global pandemic, the political turmoil, the social injustice. I won't go into detail, but it was overwhelming, can I be honest? There was moments where I was sitting in my room and I would just go, God, where are you? It feels like you're not even here. Where are you in all of this? It feels like the end of the tunnel. It feels like there's no hope. And there's a book in the Bible that talks about just that. It looks like it was the end for God's people. It looks like there was no hope. It looks like they were not going to get themselves out of this situation. And God isn't mentioned once in the entire book. What we're going to dive into today is the book of Esther. We're going to be focusing on two people, Esther and Mordecai, two Jews who were living in Persia, and they were facing a genocide against their people. Whoa, genocide, that escalated really quickly. Yep, so let me back up and give you some context. Like I said, Esther and Mordecai were Jews living in Persia after exile under King Xerxes or King Ahasuerus. Now this guy was like filthy rich and he loved to show it off. So he was having this 180-day rager. Like, this is not like a 3-day weekend Coachella. Like, he was going all out. And so he wanted to summon his beautiful queen Vashti and show her off. So he goes, hey Vashti, hey baby, let's go. Come here, baby. And she's like, nope. So this is the KB standard version, by the way. So it's not published yet. but King Xerxes goes, did she just reject me? Like, come here. She continues to deny him. And without hesitation, he's filled with rage, gives her the boot, bye Felicia, dethroned, never to be heard from again. Well, okay, so now we don't have a queen. So this queen position is available, and they have this massive national beauty contest. And guess who has the chance of a lifetime to become queen of Persia? That's right, our girl, Esther. She was just an ordinary Jewish girl just trying to live her life, and she gets entered into this contest. She ends up winning the favor of the king and becomes queen of Persia. So then we're introduced to this Haman guy. He's the villain of the story. We don't like Haman. He goes and he's elevated to second command shortly after. And then he's wanting everyone to bow down to him because he's like, look how awesome I am. And I'm like, okay, whatever. But Mordecai refuses, which is, you know, Esther's cousin. And he's filled with rage, Haman. He's going, you know what? I'm going to kill that guy because he's disrespecting me. You don't disrespect Haman. And then he goes, that's not good enough. I'm going to kill all the Jews. So now we're caught up. We got a genocide on our hands. And it's interesting the wording that Haman uses when he's putting out an edict or a decree to have this done. We see in Esther 3:13, letters were sent by couriers to each of the royal provinces telling the officials to destroy, kill, and annihilate all of the Jewish people. There's a couple of words in here that sound pretty familiar. It reminds me of what Jesus is saying when he's talking about the character of a thief in John 10:10. A thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. Now, I don't know if you got that. Steal, kill, destroy, annihilate. Isn't it ironic that Jesus uses this almost two exact words that Haman used to describe an act of evil? I mean, really think of that. We see this in the Old Testament in Esther. We're seeing this now in the New Testament in John. And it's the same tactics that the enemy is using today. He wants to steal the plan that God has on your life. He wants to kill your purpose. And he wants to annihilate any faith that you have in him. That is his ultimate goal. But we have to stand firm when we come to a crossroad, choose the way of God. We can't let the enemy steal, kill, and destroy. He cannot create. He doesn't have a big vocabulary, obviously. Only God can. He has the final say on our life. And throughout Esther, we see a lot of dialogue from Haman, our villain. I mean, this guy won't shut up. And we're like, okay, we get it. You're awesome. But we hear very little from Esther. And I believe she was behind closed doors praying. She was in the presence of God. When she was faced with this genocide against her people, her first response was to fast and pray. She knew her counts. She had set a disciplined life growing up in her Jewish culture, and she knew in times of trouble to turn to God first. So I want to ask you a couple questions. What counts are you practicing? What disciplines are you setting up in your life today that will strengthen you tomorrow? Is your foundation rooted in God's way, or is it rooted in the world's way? So how does this genocide get resolved? Well, Esther hosts Haman and the king in a banquet. She reveals her Jewish identity, and she tells the king that Haman has plotted to kill her people, so the king has him hung. And fun fact, it was actually hung on the same gallows that Haman, our villain, had built for Mordecai earlier in the story. What I can tell you is that God will always protect you in times of need. So Mordecai gets elevated, and with the help of Esther, they release a new decree. Because once this edict was sealed with the king's ring, It couldn't be undone. So they had to do a counter decree. And we see in Esther 8:11, the king's edict gave the Jews in each and every city the right to assemble and defend themselves. And get this, to destroy, kill, and annihilate every ethnic and provincial army hostile to them. So the very thing that the enemy will use to try and destroy you will always backfire. Because he does not have the final say. God has the final say in our life. So in closing, I want to summarize with Proverbs 28:18. The one who lives with integrity will be helped, but the one who distorts right and wrong will suddenly fall. So we all come to this crossroad in life like we talked today. Are you going to choose a life of integrity or a distorted worldview? Know your counts. Know that you are standing firm in God. Know his truth. Practice those daily disciplines, and you will have the chance of a lifetime. Thank you.